Picture this. You're looking at a really sleek, top-floor luxury apartment overlooking the Nile in Cairo.
Okay, I can picture that.
Right. So the paperwork slides across this polished mahogany desk. A local lawyer signs on the dotted line. A massive wire transfer clears from some obscure corporate account, and the keys are just handed over.
Mm.
To the naked eye, I mean, this is just a standard transaction in a booming real estate market.
Yeah, the broader market definitely sees it as a win for the local economy. But if we, you know, peel back the layers of that specific transaction, we might find something entirely different.
Like what?
Well, that pristine luxury condo might actually be the final resting place of a smuggled 3,000-year-old Egyptian artifact.
Oh, wild.
Right. Or it could be the proceeds of a massive narcotics operation.
That is wild. Welcome to the Deep Dive, everyone. You handed us a really fascinating stack of sources today. And looking through them, you realize that the world of modern illicit finance looks, well, absolutely nothing like the movies.
No, not at all.
The whole Hollywood trope of criminals swapping heavy black duffel bags of cash in a dimly lit parking garage is totally obsolete. Today, we are taking the materials you shared and unpacking Egypt's evolving battle against a highly complex, practically invisible, globally networked system of financial crime.
It's a massive undertaking.
It really is. Our mission today is to figure out how a country actually goes about hunting down the proceeds of drug trafficking, corruption, and antiquity smuggling. Basically, how they translate international rules into real-world action to protect an entire economy.
And to really ground our exploration here, we have to start with the cornerstone of these sources, which is Egypt's national AML-CFT strategy.
Right, which stands for anti-money laundering and combating the financing of terrorism.
Exactly. So in March of 2023, Egypt launched this massive new phase of their strategy, building on their original 2013 framework. But what stands out in the documentation isn't just, you know, the policy itself. It is the sheer scale of the ambition. They are attempting to completely rewire how information flows across the country.
I noticed that. The sources don't frame this as just some bureaucratic update that gets filed away in a cabinet. They're trying to forge a unified operating model across both financial and non-financial sectors.
Yeah, they are essentially trying to take international standards, combine them with their own internal national risk findings, and build this cohesive shield. But the core tension is always going to be protecting the stability of the financial system without strangling sustainable economic development with red tape.
Which is a tough balance. Let's unpack the actual crimes driving this, though, because having a grand national strategy sounds great in theory. But understanding the underlying crimes, what the sources call predicate crimes, really exposes the scope of the problem.
It really does.
Like in Egypt, these prominently include drug trafficking, corruption, firearms offenses, fraud, theft, and a very localized threat, which is crimes connected to stolen antiquities.
Right. And the proceeds from those predicate crimes are the engine of illicit finance. But the fundamental challenge authorities face is that this dirty money, it doesn't just sit still. It is inherently migratory.
Right. It passes through multiple different sectors, which creates this massive blind spot. I mean, the banks see isolated wire transfers, the street level police see the physical drug bust or the looted tomb.
And the national registries hold the property ownership data.
Exactly. But no single authority naturally possesses the full picture.
It's the classic blind man and the elephant problem, but applied to national security. Because everyone is holding a different, isolated piece of the puzzle, they operate under the illusion that they are dealing with completely different animals.
That makes total sense.
Like, a bank compliance officer sees a weird spike in corporate spending and flags it as a potential tax issue. They are completely unaware that a regional police unit is currently investigating that exact same corporation's CEO for arms trafficking.
I was trying to visualize this friction while reading your notes, and it feels a lot like a criminal relay race where the baton actually changes shape at every single handoff.
Oh, I like that analogy.
Right. So it starts out as a crate of looted antiquities from an excavation site. At the first handoff, a black market broker turns it into a pile of untraceable cash.
And then they run to next leg.
Exactly. At the next handoff, that cash is used to buy that luxury Nile condo we talked about earlier. And finally, in the last leg of the race, the condo is leveraged for a perfectly legitimate-looking corporate bank deposit.
It blends right in.
Yeah. So if the government only has umpires standing at the starting line and the finish line, they completely lose the race.
Because if the umpires aren't talking to each other, the baton just vanishes halfway around the track. And solving that specific relay race problem is the entire reason Egypt established its institutional architecture.
Which includes the FIU, right?
Yes, the Egyptian Money Laundering and Terrorist Financing Combating Unit, which serves as their Financial Intelligence Unit, or FIU, established back in 2002. They also set up a national coordinating committee to bridge these exact gaps.
But the sources are pretty explicit that just setting up a committee and a financial intelligence unit isn't a magic wand. I mean, you can't just mandate collaboration and expect all the silos to collapse overnight.
Oh, definitely not. Far too often, interagency meetings just devolve into mere status updates if the structural barriers to sharing raw data remain.
Right.
I mean, an FIU is designed to receive and analyze suspicious transaction reports from banks, but an FIU cannot deliver a national strategy in isolation. The mandate of this architecture is to generate actionable intelligence.
Meaning they actually have to use the data.
Exactly. It requires taking the highly sensitive data trapped inside individual banks and police departments and weaponizing it. We're talking about deploying joint task forces, establishing rapid response protocols for freezing assets, and implementing shared performance metrics across totally different government branches.
Which naturally brings us to the actual report card.
Right.
It's one thing to outline this grand interconnected plan, but we have to look at how Egypt is actually performing on the ground. The sources dive heavily into the gap between technical compliance and effectiveness.
Right. And the baseline for understanding that gap is the FATF mutual evaluation from 2021. FATF is the Financial Action Task Force. They're essentially the global watchdog for money laundering and terrorist financing.
And their 2021 evaluation presented a really fascinating split in the data. On technical compliance, which basically measures whether a country's laws actually reflect international standards, Egypt had a remarkably solid legal foundation.
They really did.
Yeah. They were rated compliant with 9 FATF recommendations, largely compliant with 23, and partially compliant with 8.
And that technical score is a major achievement for any legislative body. But FATF doesn't stop at the legal text. They measure effectiveness, which asks the much harder question, do these robust laws actually produce real-world disruption?
And there, the 2021 numbers were incredibly sobering for Egypt. Out of 11 immediate outcomes, only 4 were rated substantial.
Yeah, 6 were moderate and 1 was low.
Okay, so let's unpack this and put it in everyday terms. They essentially passed the written driving exam with flying colors by studying the manual and adopting all the right rules.
Right, they knew the theory perfectly.
But when it came to the practical driving test, actually getting in the car, chasing down the assets, and taking the criminals off the road, they were struggling to apply what was in the manual.
The friction on the ground is monumental. You have to consider the institutional muscle memory involved here. Passing a comprehensive law is just a stroke of a pen.
True.
But actually executing it requires asking a detective who has spent 20 years building physical narcotics cases by kicking down doors to suddenly sit down and untangle a web of international corporate balance sheets. A strong rulebook doesn't automatically train forensic accountants, you know, or speed up court convictions.
But to be fair to the timeline in the sources, Egypt hasn't just been sitting on those 2021 scores. They've made some significant upgrades. By 2024, they hit compliant on standards covering money transfer services.
Yes, they did.
And looking ahead to 2025, they've managed to upgrade their rating on the actual money laundering offense to largely compliant.
Which is great, but even with those significant legislative upgrades, the latest published follow-up showed Egypt remained in what FATF calls enhanced follow-up.
Meaning they're still being watched closely?
Exactly. The international watchdog is keeping them under a microscope because the ultimate goal is the utilization of those laws. And this highlights one of the most critical operational shifts detailed in the strategy, which is the implementation of parallel financial investigations.
I really want to spend some time on this because it seems to be the linchpin of the whole effectiveness problem. My understanding of a parallel financial investigation is that instead of waiting for the dust to settle on a crime, law enforcement sends the forensic accountants through the door at the exact same time as the SWAT team.
That captures the dynamic perfectly. Traditionally, law enforcement operates sequentially. They might spend months wiretapping a drug trafficking ring, execute a massive raid, secure the drugs, arrest the foot soldiers, and then focus their entire legal strategy on securing a narcotics conviction.
Right.
Only after the dust settles, maybe months later, do they finally ask, hey, where did the millions of dollars from this operation actually go?
By which point, the money is completely gone.
Long gone. If you wait for the predicate case to wrap up, those funds have been layered through a dozen accounts, wired to offshore jurisdictions, and placed totally beyond the legal reach of Egyptian authorities.
So parallel investigations change the timeline.
Exactly. They mandate that from day one of the drug bust or the antiquities seizure, dedicated financial investigators are actively identifying the money trail. They are simultaneously mapping the legal entities, pinpointing the professional facilitators, and freezing the assets connected to the criminal conduct.
And it seems like following the money from the jump doesn't just secure the assets, it also allows you to map out the entire org chart. I mean, the guys moving the drugs on the street aren't the ones pulling the strings. The money trail leads you straight to the top of the pyramid.
Yes. Following the finances often exposes entirely new criminal networks and elite facilitators that the original street-level bust completely missed. It shifts the investigation from targeting the symptom to targeting the actual disease.
But if we think back to our criminal relay race, here is where law enforcement hits a massive brick wall. Because the baton isn't just being handed off to other criminals standing in a dark alley. It's being handed off in plain sight, deliberately hidden within the most legitimate economic structures available.
That is the hardest part to catch.
Right. If I'm a sophisticated criminal syndicate with $10 million to launder, I am absolutely not walking into a major, highly regulated international bank with a duffel bag of cash. They would flag me in 3 seconds.
No, instantly.
So I'm going to pivot to something softer. I'm setting up 3 layers of shell companies and buying a portfolio of high-end real estate.
And that pivot is the exact reason why Egypt's national strategy is desperately trying to reach beyond the banking sector. Criminal proceeds inevitably migrate to the path of least resistance. In the compliance industry, we call these softer targets DNFBPs.
Which stands for Designated Non-Financial Businesses and Professions.
Exactly. We're talking about real estate agents, legal professionals, independent accountants, and dealers in precious metals and stones.
People who don't necessarily think of themselves as being on the front lines of financial crime.
Right. But these non-financial sectors frequently, and sometimes inadvertently, provide the ultimate cover for illicit value. A real estate agent just sees a wealthy foreign buyer. An accountant sees a complex corporate retainer.
So how do you fix that?
To combat this, the strategy leans heavily on the concept of beneficial ownership. Authorities and these independent professionals are required by law to drill down through the corporate paperwork to identify the actual living, breathing, natural person who ultimately owns or controls the entity making the transaction.
But the sources stress that simply filling out a registration form with the government isn't the finish line. I mean, a criminal can just write down their cousin's name on the paperwork.
Oh, for sure. Company registration is merely the opening act. The data filed in national registries has to be rigorously verified. It must be accurate, kept current, and easily accessible to law enforcement, especially in high-risk sectors like real estate or gold trading.
Give me an example of how this fails in practice if they don't do that.
Okay, so imagine a criminal sets up a trust in an offshore tax haven. That trust then owns a holding company, which then hires a local nominee director in Cairo to actually buy the property.
Okay, I'm with you.
If a local real estate agent only checks a generic list of red flags and just accepts the local nominee's ID at face value, the criminal successfully vanishes behind a massive wall of legal paperwork.
It effectively renders the local real estate agent or accountant totally blind to the fact that they are laundering millions of dollars.
Yeah.
Because they lack the sector-specific typologies to recognize how the money is being layered.
Exactly. Without a deep, granular understanding of how these corporate mazes are constructed, those non-financial sectors remain incredibly vulnerable. They essentially become the weakest link in the national shield.
Now, let's add a massive accelerant to this entire problem, which is the digital modernization of the Egyptian economy. The sources focus heavily on how technology is revolutionizing legitimate business, but it's simultaneously revolutionizing how crime operates.
It's a huge shift.
We're looking at a profound digital double-edged sword here.
We really are. The digital transformation in Egypt is an incredible engine for financial inclusion. Bringing unbanked populations into the formal economy is a massive developmental priority for them. But digital financial services bring a host of unique high-speed risks right along with them.
Because Egypt is rapidly expanding things like mobile wallets, instant payment networks, and electronic place. Know your customer processes, what the industry calls EKYC.
Right.
I keep picturing this as building a beautifully paved, high-speed economic superhighway. The stated goal is to let everyday citizens drive onto this highway and participate in the economy with zero friction.
Which is a great goal.
But the terrifying realization for law enforcement is that the getaway cars get to drive much faster on that exact same superhighway.
That's spot on. The velocity of digital transactions fundamentally alters the risk landscape. Now, it's true that digital channels generate an incredibly rich data trail that physical cash simply doesn't leave behind. Every click, every IP address, every transfer leaves a permanent digital footprint.
But if a criminal syndicate gets their hands on stolen identities, they can use that frictionless eKYC process to open 50 mobile wallets in an hour. They can layer stolen funds across all of them in 3 seconds and cash out before a human compliance officer even gets an alert on their screen.
Exactly. The speed of the transaction just outpaces traditional monitoring. And this complexity deepens even more when we look at virtual assets like cryptocurrency.
Which was really interesting in the sources.
Yeah, the sources explicitly note that Egypt strictly prohibits dealing in virtual assets within its regulated banking framework.
I found that detail really striking because logically, passing a law that bans crypto doesn't magically erase the underlying market demand or the criminal activity.
Well, of course not. A prohibition in the regulated banking sector merely pushes the activity into the shadows. The black market simply does not respect regulatory bans.
Right, they don't care.
So Egyptian authorities still bear the heavy burden of actively tracking crypto-linked transactions. They have to hunt down unlicensed peer-to-peer transfer providers operating under the radar, and they have to navigate really complex international cooperation agreements when illicit value is inevitably moved through foreign crypto exchanges or unhosted wallets.
So when technology is evolving at this breakneck pace, and the bad actors are always an early adopter, how does a national strategy actually keep up with that?
The documents point to a crucial operational mandate, which is proactive risk assessment. Financial institutions and regulators must assess the money laundering risks of emerging tech products before they are allowed to launch in the market.
So they can't just fix it after the fact.
Exactly. There has to be clear, unambiguous ownership of technology risk. And furthermore, there needs to be radical cross-functional intelligence sharing.
What does that look like inside a bank?
Well, if a bank's cybersecurity team detects a data breach and the fraud team investigates the stolen funds and the AML team monitors the underlying network, they cannot operate in isolated silos. They must share intelligence in real time because the criminals are actively exploiting the bureaucratic gaps between those exact departments.
It all circles back to breaking down the silos, whether it's between government agencies or even between departments inside a single bank.
It really does.
Which brings us to the ultimate question of the deep dive. We've explored the grand strategy, the struggle to translate technical laws into real-world effectiveness, the maze of beneficial ownership, and the lightning speed of digital money. How does a country actually hit organized crime where it hurts?
The absolute ultimate credibility test of any anti-money laundering regime is confiscation. It is the single metric that dictates whether crime actually becomes less profitable.
Because for the people leading this fight, the definition of success isn't whether a bank successfully filed a suspicious activity report or even if a street-level dealer went to jail. The definition of success is whether you permanently removed the profit motive from the equation.
Exactly. Consider what happens when you secure a criminal conviction but fail to seize the assets. If the mastermind goes to prison but their millions remain untouched in offshore accounts and luxury real estate, those funds remain fully available to their associates, their family, or a successor network.
You haven't actually disrupted the organized crime syndicate. You've merely forced a temporary change in upper management.
Right. The business keeps running. This is why MENAFATIF, which is the regional body for the Middle East and North Africa, is placing enormous pressure on Egypt to trace the full values of criminal proceeds.
What are they directing them to do?
The directive is to confiscate property of equivalent value if the original cash has been dissipated, and to aggressively utilize international cooperation to freeze assets that have been smuggled abroad.
Achieving that level of disruption requires a fundamental shift in how the government interacts with the private sector. You can't just view the banks, the fintech companies, and the real estate agents as subjects to be audited and fined.
No, the private sector has to be elevated to the role of active intelligence partners. A major international bank and a local Cairo real estate firm hold completely different, fragmented views of the exact same criminal network.
Right.
If you establish properly governed, secure frameworks for information sharing, you can cross-reference those views. Suddenly, you reveal linked accounts, expose common beneficial owners hiding behind nominees, and map out laundering infrastructure that no single entity could possibly detect on its own.
So, based on the entirety of the sources you looked at, what does a truly resilient, fully actualized model look like in practice?
A resilient model translates strategy into daily operational reality. Every single objective has a named owner, a hard deadline, a dedicated resource plan, and a measurable real-world outcome.
So it's not just a theoretical framework anymore.
Exactly. It means the financial intelligence unit receives structured, regular feedback from law enforcement, so they actually know if their financial intelligence is leading to arrests or if it's just noise. It means regulators are armed with granular, sector-level data so they can direct their audits at the highest risk institutions rather than just conducting random checks.
That makes total sense.
And most importantly, it means investigators and prosecutors are stepping in on day one, utilizing those parallel financial investigations to trace and freeze complex assets before they can vanish into the global financial system.
It is an incredibly complex, monumental undertaking. But stepping back and looking at the full scope of the sources you provided, you really get a clear view of the massive journey Egypt is on. We started by looking at the fragmented, practically invisible puzzle of networked crime, where the baton is constantly changing shape and changing hands.
Yeah, that relay race is complicated.
Very. We explored why it is so critical to move past the written test of technical compliance and get out on the road with parallel investigations. We navigated the maze of beneficial ownership transparency, highlighting why criminals flock to real estate and shell companies. And we examined the profound double-edged sword of digital modernization.
And through all of this complexity, the true endgame of Egypt's strategy remains fiercely focused. It is about engineering an integrated nationwide system that can detect illicit value, pierce the corporate veil to find the natural persons pulling the strings, and surgically remove the financial benefit entirely.
Long before it can be reinvested into future crime or acts of terrorism.
Exactly.
It fundamentally comes down to removing the incentive. Which leaves me with a final thought for you to mull over as we wrap up today's deep dive. We spent a lot of time discussing how digital payments act like a superhighway. You know, speeding up those getaway cars and making it easier for bad actors to move money faster than ever before.
Right, the velocity problem.
Yeah. But here is something to chew on. If taking away the financial incentive is the ultimate way to kill organized crime, could the very thing making crime faster right now eventually become the exact tool that makes money laundering utterly impossible?
You mean a fully traceable, digital-only economy?
Exactly. Imagine a future where physical cash is gone and every single cent in existence has a permanent, unalterable digital fingerprint from the exact moment it's created.
A permanent ledger for every transfer.
Right. Where could the criminals possibly hide their baton then? Think about that, and we'll catch you on the next deep dive.